You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 323 of the Talking Chop podcast. I am your host, Brad Roland. It is Wednesday, October 27th, heading into October 28th, and the Atlanta Braves are now tied in the World Series after losing to the Houston Astros in Game 2, and I am joined, as often, by Scott Coleman to discuss it all. Hello, Scott.
Hey, Brad. How you doing, buddy? It's not the podcast we were hoping to do, but I think if you would have told any Braves fan 48 hours ago that they were going to split in Houston, I think you take it, and hopefully the series shifts to Atlanta and they're able to get back in their winning ways here soon.
Certainly. You want to get greedy and win both, but given the home field advantage, whatever you think about home field advantage, it matters on some level, and to go in there and get a split is, you know, not exactly like fully satisfying, particularly in the order that it was in, but still, big picture to your point, I think they did a pretty good job and getting one of those two games. They never led in Game 2. We'll dive into all of it, as always. But defensively, it was like a catastrophe in this game for the Braves. In a weird way, they haven't had that kind of meltdown all season, really, in the field. And I noted this from somebody, I can't remember who, but the Astros still have not lost back-to-back games of any kind since August 23rd. So I guess they're they don't lose back-to-back games, apparently. I was hoping that was going to not be a stat that continued, but there you go. So, you know, we'll get into this, but there were lots of storylines early and then I would say less of them later on. Houston ends up scoring first, but even before that, I know Braves fans were very upset immediately because of the strike zone that was in play by Ron Culpa. In this game, you know, in a game that's as lopsided as this one ended up being, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but I think it's at least, it was the first thing that was like popping up all over my timeline. And that is that the strike zone was like both enormous and kind of weird in a lot of ways. And it kind of struck right away with a couple of strikeouts. And I don't know what, I wrote this down, I guess I'll just say it now. One of those score websites had Ron Culpa as the number 71 out of 74 full-time umpires graded behind the plate this year in terms of accuracy. That's not what you want in a World Series game. So when combined with that number, I'm not telling that's not gospel by any means. I'm sure they have better numbers in terms of evaluating umpires than baseball actually has. But with my eyes and your eyes and Twitter's eyes and Baseball Savant and that number coming together, it's like a little bit frustrating that was happening in the spot.
Yeah, it is. And frustrating is the perfect word. And no umpire is perfect. And I guess if you're trying to give Ron Culpa the benefit of the doubt, he was consistent. He was consistently bad and seemed to expand the strike zone, especially for Houston's pitching staff tonight. And I'm sure there were moments where the Braves got a call and those don't stick out as much, but yes, from the get-go, Freddie Freeman struck out and he only saw one strike in the zone. Like that just can't happen. I know the automated strike zone is a very, very hot point of debate among baseball fans and probably the league itself. It brings in that human element. And tonight there were some really tough calls. I know Jock Peterson struck out late in the game and kind of got into it with Ron a little bit, and I don't blame him. And it was a strike to Jock that he struck out on, but I think it was just some boiling over and frustrations from a tough night offensively for the team. But yeah, not a good night at the plate. And you know, anytime I believe now the Braves, this was the 12th postseason game the Braves have played And according to umpire scorecards, they have been on the wrong side of the home plate umpire in 11 of those 12 games. That is crazy. And again, as you said, that it's not a perfect measurement by any means, but to be on the wrong side of a strike zone, 11 out of 12 games is crazy and frustrating and just kind of makes you ask what on earth is going on here.
Yeah. And again, I don't want to belabor this too much, but it was my first note because it was right out of the gate. Like there was no like delay. It was like the fifth pitch of the game. People were already mad at the umpire and it wasn't even wrong necessarily. So, you know, they did have two base runners in the first inning. That was a squandered opportunity that, you know, they could have used some runs in that spot. Because in the bottom half, Max Free takes the ball. You know, as we talked about last night a lot with Eric and I, with Charlie Morton out for the series, Max Fried takes on a role that is even more important, and he was not his absolute best in this game. He did kind of find it later on, which we'll talk about, but he got hit pretty good in the first inning. Only one run allowed, but a double to Altuve, a sac fly that was hit pretty swiftly, another sac fly to get the run home. Bregman kind of smoked one in that spot. And, you know, it felt like it was kind of an escape to be only down one at that point in time. But, you know, we'll get into the second thing in a second. But I guess before we dive in, like, what did you think of Max Free? Because it was kind of he didn't – like, the batted ball data was not too ugly for Max, but he wasn't missing bats early on, and the contact was, like, pretty solid against him. And the results, while not all on him because of the defensive stuff and sort of the BABIP luck, I have a hard time trying to figure out, like, how good or bad he was in this game. He wasn't good, I can tell you that, but I don't know how bad he was either.
Yeah. He did settle in nicely as the game progressed, which is an encouraging sign, and he helped save the bullpen. And as you noted, his final line looks better because of that, but he was not sharp. He gave up the leadoff double, and then he did get out of the inning unscathed besides the Altuve run. But both of those balls were hit very well. Adam Duvall made a nice play in the gap to catch one. And it was really just kind of reminiscent of the Dodgers series. He wasn't terrible, but he just wasn't the same Max Fried that we saw in the second half of the year. And especially without Charlie Morton, the Braves need Max Fried to be good. He was not great tonight. And I think there's maybe something to build off of that. He kind of found his groove a little bit because he looked a little deer in the headlights during that disastrous second inning. But on a night where the Braves could have taken a 2-0 lead in the World Series heading back home to Atlanta, Fried was not sharp, and we'll dig into that disastrous second inning here in a minute, which I would argue some of which was probably his doing and some was not. But again, it was just not a great night for Max.
Yeah, and I agree with that characterization of second inning too. We'll get there now. The top of the second was actually one of the better moments of the night for the Braves. Travis d'Arnaud hits a home run to left field with two outs to tie the game. And I kind of rolled my eyes in approving fashion because Eric and I spent, I don't know, maybe 2 minutes, not a lot of time last night, but we did reference the fact that d'Arnaud has kind of been their worst hitter for a while now. And of course he hits the home run to tie the game
naturally
in his first at bat, which listen, bring it on. Go ahead, Travis. That's fine with me. But, you know, that was a brief moment of optimism. And then the second inning, which we both just teased, let's just talk about it now. A couple of singles at the outset with Tucker and Gurriel. And the Gurriel one was the one that people were mad at because it was a shift beater. They were shifting on him, and we'll come back to that at the end, I think. But that happens to first and third against Max. Then a total mess of a play. Maldonado, the catcher, has a ground ball single that was one of those seeing eye varieties. He actually had a .230 expected batting average to drive in a run. And then you have the defensive mess with Eddie Rosario throwing the ball to no one at third base, which scored another run because the ball kicked away, which puts you down 4-1. And then Fried has a wild pitch to get the runner to third. Actually, they benefited from Altuve not hitting the ball very far, and Maldonado, who's pretty slow, couldn't score. But then, of course, Michael Brantley hits a single with two outs, and it's 5-1 anyway. So, you know, one could say I saw a lot of screenshots of the Baseball Savant data about how, like, these balls were not hit that hard and they had, like, relatively low expected batting averages. And it's true. This is an inning where five singles happened and none of them were hit particularly hard. But at the same time, you have the defensive mess, which is obviously your own doing. You have the wild pitch, which is your own doing. And then you can't just expect that nothing's ever going to get through the infield. So there's a lot to get to, including the shift stuff. But I mean, what do you take from this? Like, there's even a talk about like whose fault it was on the defensive mess, because someone mentioned that like maybe Rauch should have been the cutoff man and Dansby should have got the third, all this stuff. It's like one of those innings in capital letters as what that you would describe this, but nothing went well for about 20 minutes.
No, it was worst case scenario across the board. And something that the Astros do really well is, and we talked about this in the preview podcast a little bit, is they led baseball. They had the fewest strikeouts. They do put the ball in play more than your average team. And they just, it was just kind of a perfect storm. And, you know, on the shift, I'll say this, the shift is what it is. If teams were dumping literally millions of dollars into their front office and analytics department to get this information to shift as frequently as they do, and it wasn't working, they wouldn't continue to do it. And, you know, it's beating a dead horse, but whenever you hit into the shift, no one remembers it. But whenever you hit one against the shift, even if it really hurts, of course you're going to remember it all night long. And look, I wish that Ozzy was standing at second base where two of those weakly hit balls were hit in the inning. It's a whole different ball game at that point. But yeah, I mean, it was, then you pile on a couple of weak singles on top of the defensive miscue with Rosario. I don't know what happened there. It was so frustrating. It was like one of those you try to put out of your mind a little bit. Again, one ball was hit harder than 100 miles off the bat. And again, it's funny just talking about last night and then tonight, the games are almost flipped entirely. Like the Braves took such an early commanding lead in game one and then cruised. And tonight the Astros took an early commanding lead and cruised. And there was not a ton of drama or high stress in either of these games. And again, and you know, it was a frustrating way to go out tonight with all the weak contact against Fried. But yeah, it's just hopefully an inning to get past and forget, and hopefully they bounce back.
Yeah, there was clearly some bad BABIP luck too. Like the infield single that scored the second run of the game was just unlucky in a lot of ways. There was definitely some unlucky stuff in this inning. Now, there was some afflicted stuff as well. The shift conversation, you know, I think you put it very well there. I would again plug the Mike Petriello piece that we've talked about before on the podcast about how much the shift has helped the Atlanta Braves this season. It's like kind of foolproof the way that he laid it out and all the numbers and how good they've been defensively in that period of time. So I have no time for the like get mad at the shift when it doesn't work thing. I get it. I understand the frustration truly. And a lot of the responses to me pointing that out were like, you know, try to point out that, you know, the playoffs are different, and it's like, well, no, it's, I mean, they are, but it doesn't make, I mean, they would still not, they would do it if they, like kind of what you said, they would only do it if it was supposed to work in terms
and everyone's favorite analyst Alex Rodriguez said something about a week ago that made me and I think everyone laughed, and his line was, well, good hitters find a way to beat the shift, and in the playoffs good hitters figure out ways to beat the shift. And it's like, well, yes, Alex, you have cracked the code. You want to hit the ball where the defensive player is not standing. Like, well, if it was
a lot of the responses too were that. And I'm not trying to poke fun at anybody. It's just, yes, approaches may be different in the playoffs. I'm not going to tell you that's definitely not true.
Yep.
But you know, your point that you're getting them there now is like, yeah, that's what they're trying to do. Like the only one that I think that I thought anyone really had a problem with that I thought was maybe reasonable was the Gurriel shift, because I think it was Mike Petriello pointed this out. Somebody smarter than I am pointed it out. That like, he's kind of like one of the guys in baseball that you maybe don't want to shift, because he's like a spray chart guy. Like he led the league in batting average this year, and like is definitely a bat control kind of guy who might actually be able to do what you're saying. Like how many guys in baseball can actually do that? The list is not very long.
Right.
But Gurriel might actually be an exception to that. I'm not telling you that he is, but I thought that was at least a reasonable line of inquiry, just to say, look, maybe don't shift him. But overall, like, I think it's very easy to see if you read Mike's piece or look at any of the numbers, like how much the shift has helped the Braves. So they did not lose this game because of the shift. I mean that, I know that very, very well in my mind. I mean, I'm sure maybe somebody thinks that, but I don't think that's the case.
Yeah. Have the Braves simply considered just standing wherever the baseball is going to be hit? Has anyone brought that idea up yet? I don't know. I think they'd be really successful if they figured out exactly where the ball was going every single time.
I think I said it in Slack, and I think Chris Willis, our fearless leader, tweeted out my quote. It was something like, we should only shift when it works, basically. Something like that was like I was making fun of.
Exactly right. And I know we're harping on this, but like, come on. That obviously,
it's mad. Listen, okay. Yeah. To play devil's advocate on my own self, playoff baseball will make you crazy, and I'm not. I do understand the frustration when you do know like where a second baseman has stood for most of your life and that guy's not there and a hit goes there. So there is a raw like mental thing that can rattle you in that moment if you're a fan. And I totally get that. I'm trying to take a step back and just point out like, look, it's helped the Braves this year pretty objectively. And, you know, they got unlucky in that inning. Max wasn't great. And I pointed this out, I think during the inning, you know, there's the whole make contact thing, and you pointed out the Astros don't really strike out. Max was not missing bats either. And yes, it's unlucky that all of those became singles. That's like objectively true. If you look at the expected batting average for all five of those to become singles was very unlikely. Mm-hmm. But you know, three of them becoming singles is likely. You know what I mean? Like when you don't miss bats, and I think at that point, I think he had two swings and misses in the first, like, I don't know, something like 12, 15 batters, something like that. He just wasn't missing bats early on. And that kind of opens the door for BABIP luck going against you. So at any rate, being down 5-1 at that point was probably one of the more unlikely scenarios. But I do think if you look at all, even just the batted ball data, you're supposed to probably be losing at that point. Maybe not 5-1, but maybe it's 3-1 or it's 4-1. And it was unlucky, but it also was self-inflicted. And I would love to, I'm sure they even talked about it. Maybe somebody asked him and I just missed it as we're recording the podcast. I want to know what happened on that play to third base. Like, just like, I'm just curious as to whose fault that's supposed to be. Is it Rosario? Is it Riley? Is it Swanson? I don't know the answer. I'm not a person that knows that. I looked at it multiple times trying to figure it out. And I don't know, but it was bad.
Yeah. It was just a bad inning. I mean, truly it's one thing if you go out there and they hit four home runs and you're like, wow, that's bad. It was just an accumulation and a comedy of errors almost at one point, and nothing was hit hard. It was just, everything was away from a defensive player. And if Max was able to get a strikeout or two, it's probably a different inning. If one or two of those ground balls is at somebody instead of in a hole, it's a different inning. But that's baseball, man. Like, it's going to happen. Hopefully at some point it balances out and the Braves have an inning where they just hit a bunch of weak grounders and nobody catches them. But tonight it was the difference, and you just kind of, I don't know, tip your hat and move on, I guess.
Yeah, and that's what we'll do now. So we talked about second inning. We'll bury that far, far, far under the ground. Before we get to the rest of the game and look ahead to game three and beyond, a word from our sponsors on the show today.
Vacations can be tricky. You already know how to book flights and hotels, but now the only thing you're missing is, you know, the actual travel experience. Because is it really a vacation if you're just sitting around like you would at home? You need a tool to get the most out of your time away. That's where Viator steps in. You can book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected. And 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
The 82-game preseason is in the books, and it's finally time for the real season. Don't miss out on any of the NBA playoff action at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NBA. From the play-in tournament through the finals, DraftKings Sportsbook has you covered. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app and use code SMASH. New customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets instantly. That's code SMASH, only on DraftKings. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or in West Virginia, visit 1-800-GAMBLER.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly. On behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort in Kansas, 21 and over, age varies by jurisdiction. Void in Ontario. Bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See dkng.co/bball for eligibility and deposit restrictions, terms, and responsible gaming resources.
All right, Scott, let us breeze through the rest of this thing because, as we have alluded to, they never really got close after that. The third and fourth innings were as fast as playoff innings ever go. It was 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3. Two straight innings. The Braves only saw 19 total pitches against Urquidy, which was not ideal, you know, but I would say, if you look at the way that he was throwing strikes. So you maybe there's like the trade-off of you don't want to just like let strikes go by. So I'm not like picking on them. It just didn't work. And then the fifth inning, the next run scored was actually on a Travis d'Arnaud singles, gets a wild pitch advance, and then Freddie drives him in. It's 5-2, and it's not over by any means because Max Fried got 10 guys in a row set down, and you're down by three. Like, you know, you're not supposed to win at that point in time. You're definitely an underdog. But it wasn't like all hope was lost in the fifth inning. They had to actually like make a big set of plays, and it just kind of never came.
Yeah, it was encouraging tonight to see Travis get a couple of hits and the home run. And as you said, it was weird. Throughout the entire night, the deficit felt bigger than it was. Like for this entire game. You know, it was 3-4, I guess at one point. I mean, it got to 5 runs at one point, but it felt like the Braves were down by a dozen. And every inning I found myself saying, okay, get a hit and another hit and then see what happens. They just never could put together a couple of hits to string together and cut this lead down, but it was encouraging to get to 5-2. And on a night right after the bullpen had to cover 7 innings following Charlie Morton's unfortunate departure, it was good for Max to be able to cover those middle innings, and they were clean innings. He didn't throw a ton of pitches either tonight, which is good. Hopefully that helps him out whenever he starts next, presumably Game 5 or Game 6, depending on how they want to do it. But yeah, I mean, for Freddie to drive in d'Arnaud with 2 outs and make it 5-2, it was still very much a game. It was keeping the hope alive. It just, unfortunately, the offensive support never came.
It did not. And part of the reason why it might have felt like they were down more than they were was even like the way they handled the pitching staff. And it didn't bite them in this game. I'm not even saying that it did, but, you know, they tried to stay with Fried in the sixth. And I get it because he had looked great for about, you know, almost 3 innings at that point in time. You're trying to save the bullpen, and I get that. But he comes out in the sixth, gives up a walk to Alvarez. I thought he was going to come out then because, you know, I probably was in mentally like one base runner mode for Max for a while, and he hadn't had a base runner in a long time. But he left him in for one more, a single by Correa, and then he comes out and they bring in Dylan Lee. And I'm not trying to pick on Dylan Lee, but I didn't expect Dylan Lee to be pitching in a game when the Braves were down by 3 runs in the sixth inning. Like it feels like a kind of a punt move in a World Series game with a day off the next day. I was a little bit confused by that. I will say Dylan Lee was good. He gave up a run, but it was not his fault in any way, shape, or form. So he gets a force out when he comes in. Then they have a double play ball, at least a potential double play ball. Swanson flips to Albies, who seems to catch it and loses it on the transfer, and they called it safe on the field. It was upheld on replay. I think it should have been an out. I will say in real time, it looked like more of an out than it was on the slow motion replay, which is kind of where replay always fools you. Regardless, though, that was an instance where the defense let him down in a big way. You know, Ozzie's always great defensively, and he just wasn't in that spot. And eventually, you know, a run scores on that play. But Lee objectively did his job. He got 2 ground balls in a row, got a strikeout, and like, yeah, you got to take that. But at the same time, your deficit grows from 3-4.
Yeah, you know, Dylan Lee has quietly been an impressive bullpen arm these last couple games. He was more than efficient tonight. I mean, he should have had a clean inning to get out of it. Ozzy not only misplayed the trying to throw to first, but he also made kind of an errant throw to Dansby at second. I don't think they would have had a double play, but the throw was kind of up and away from Dansby and prevented any chance of turning a double play on the batter before. But Lee did his job. I mean, he was throwing strikes. He had an impressive outing. I think it was game five against the Dodgers. He, I believe, covered two innings, gave up a home run to Chris Taylor, but that was the night Chris Taylor had like 15 hits or whatever it was. So I don't think you can fault Dylan too much for that. And obviously you have a couple of really good lefties in this bullpen, but if you are looking for positives to take away from this game, I think Lee has earned himself a chance to maybe not come in the biggest moment of the game, but he was surprisingly very effective and good. And again, we just talked about how it was a closer game than it felt, even with the Astros getting the lead to 6-2, it was still very much a game at that point.
Yeah, it was. They just never made anything happen from there. They bring in Chavez. It was weird. Chavez got one out and they took him out. And I was kind of confused by that.
Yeah.
A situation where you're down four, you don't usually bring in a guy that you like kind of trust to get one out in the sixth, but that's what happened. They brought in Drew Smyly in the seventh, which is also a little bit weird to me. Not that it was super weird, but yeah, you're only quote unquote down by four. And I kind of thought they might use Smyly, and they still could use him as a bolt guy in game four, game five, but he comes in there and throws, you know, one inning. I don't know what the plan was there. But the first pitch, of course, is a Jose Altuve tomahawk home run. So it's not like Smyly was dialed in, but I wrote that down just to make sure, to keep myself honest. I wrote down before he came in, I don't know why he's pitching here, just because it didn't make – or my other thought was basically, okay, maybe they just let Smyly pitch the rest of this game.
Yeah, yeah.
And they did the other thing. They had to pitch an inning. And I was like, okay, that was a little bit strange. I don't really care that much. It was just a bit odd.
Yeah, with the power that's in this Houston lineup, they need to be very selective with how they utilize Drew Smyly in this series. And he did pitch well against the Dodgers in, I think, game four of the NLCS, and that certainly resonates. But, yeah, it was just kind of an odd bullpen night. And it is a positive that, again, you don't always want to lose this way, but if you can lose and not have to go through Matzik and Luke Jackson and
they use nobody. The four right. guys they trust that we all kind of laughed about, that they only trust four guys, they didn't pitch.
And that's probably not insignificant, knowing that while they do have a day off tomorrow, they have three games in a row, like guaranteed, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And you hope that if the Braves are winning or within a couple runs, obviously you're going to utilize those guys, especially as we get deeper in the series, right? Like they have 5 months to rest after this. But it's not insignificant, right? You don't always want to use the excuse of, well, if you're going to lose a game, you'd rather lose by five runs than one run. But it is a positive. We're looking for takeaways here that are good, right?
We were searching high and low.
Even if there weren't a ton of them. But the eighth inning was very encouraging from young Kyle Wright, who I continue to believe in.
That was a pro tease right there, Scott. Congratulations.
I've learned from you.
Honestly, of all the things that happen in the entire game, I don't want to overstate it, but it's possible that was one of the more encouraging ones was Kyle Wright, who struck out the side in the eighth. Kyle Wright has tantalized everyone. I think we've all had a dance or two with Kyle Wright optimism, maybe three, maybe four, maybe five times. I'm not sure, maybe more than that. You know, a former top pick, all that stuff. He looked the part of the guy that he is always potentially been and never really been. It's one inning, but he was fairly dominant in that inning. And I wonder if that earns him a little bit of a tab when it comes to game four, game five. And he's already on the roster. And they brought in Tucker Davidson today in place of Charlie Morton. But a lot of the questions we got last night, and Eric and I tried to answer while also just admitting that we didn't really know the background, is like who is ready to go, who is stretched out. But regardless, you know, right through great, it's one inning, but it was one fun inning, like in the middle of this wasteland.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's funny. Kyle Wright Touki Toussaint. There's a reason that pitching prospects can be so frustrating, but also they can tease you as much as they do, because we have seen Kyle Wright look really effective at times. And then we have also seen nights where it's like, oh my God, like this kid is just not it. Like, yep. You got to get him back to Gwinnett. Hey, if it gets Kyle some confidence, and who knows what games 4 and 5, I mean, they're effectively going to throw or need to cover 18 plus innings of bullpen game following Ian Anderson's start on Friday afternoon or Friday night. I guarantee you, well, I guess I can't guarantee you, but I think after tonight, I can strongly promise you that that Kyle Wright's probably going to get in one of those games. Again, it was one inning, but he looked really good. He struck out the side. And hey, if it gets Kyle some confidence on the mound, if he could cover a couple innings in games 4 or 5, it would be huge.
Yep. And we'll leave it there on that. But, you know, not having to use anybody, getting through that with Wright in the eighth, having it look good, you know, small takeaway, small positives, but they were positives nonetheless. Before we look ahead, a couple of just like housekeeping items of this game. Only Travis Arnoux reached base multiple times for the Braves in this game, so it's not like it was an offensive explosion. And the outfield, the starting outfield in this game, was 0 for 4, 0 for 4, 0 for 4. 0 for 12, no walks. That's tough.
Yeah.
It's one game sample size, but you know, that's what happened. As we talked about, they didn't use any of the four relievers that they trust. And that's kind of like it for the game. You know, we can talk about Max Fried and like frustrations, but you know, at the same time, you're still hoping Max Fried is making a start in game 6 and is your guy. I mean, he is, for as not inspiring as he has been the last two starts, he is still your best available pitcher with Charlie Morton out for the season. So you have to just be what it is there. Anything else you want to say about this game before we look at Tucker Davidson and the rest of the series?
Forget about it and move on. I mean, again, I know we talked about it on the at the top, but you split in Houston. Game 1, a lot of fun. Game 2 is not. Game 2 was about as frustrating as it can be. You move on. You hopefully get back home to Atlanta and get some rest and recharge your batteries. And now you have 3 just enormous games coming up. And I think it was natural to be frustrated and disappointed tonight. Everyone, I mean, the idea of going up 2-0 on the road in the World Series is huge. And while we certainly would have liked that to happen tonight, I think it's important to remember that they split the series. And while it was frustrating to lose tonight, if they would have lost game 1 and then won game 2, while in the old momentum, it might feel a little bit better. As we've seen, this team is never shy, and they're going to bounce right back. They've been beat down before, and they've come back in a strong way. Hopefully they just move on, and Houston's a very good team. We saw that tonight. They have a deep lineup. Their bullpen is good. They're not going to lay down. They've been here before, and now the Braves have to swing back and hopefully get back ahead in the series.
Yes, we are on the same page with all of that. We alluded to it earlier, but they did choose Tucker Davidson to replace Morton on the roster. A slight surprise, but he's pretty intriguing. And we did discuss him last night with Eric on the show. And the big question we had with a lot of the guys that they had that were theoretically options were basically, are they healthy and are they still pitching? Are they stretched out? Because the Braves have been very secretive with their taxi squad. But Davidson did some media actually today before the game and kind of answered that. He said he's been working at Gwinnett for since the season ended. He actually had a rehab start in Gwinnett on October 3rd after he went on the IL in mid-June with a forearm strain. But they called him last night, basically, the front office did, and said, go to Houston. So he traveled today and was the guy there. He also said that he stretched out to 75 or 80 pitches was the way that he said. Obviously, I don't think he's going to throw – I would guess he doesn't throw it much. But the fact that he could is potentially useful. But, you know, we talked about Touki. We talked about Sean Newcomb. We talked about Spencer Strider. Like, all the guys you might expect as, like, potential options, you know, Kyle Muller. But if Davidson is healthy, and you have to presume that he is, and stretched out, like, he would have been near the top of my list of guys to add. Yeah. So I'm cool with this.
No, I was pleasantly surprised. I mean, we have seen, as we just talked about, we've seen Touki be effective at the big league level, but we've also seen him where he can't even throw a strike. And similar to Kyle Muller, I thought he was a dark horse option as well. But again, if you're not going to throw strikes, that's really a problem I mean, in general, it's a problem, but in the playoffs, it is especially a problem. And hey, good on Tucker Davidson, man. It was easy to forget, but he was really effective in his handful of starts back in June. Granted, it has been a while since he's pitched at a high level because of that forearm strain, but the fact that he's ready to go. And as we just said, the Braves have to cover 18 bullpen innings in games 4 and 5. I think Tucker Davidson's going to get a shot, and it's certainly a little bit of a scary proposition for a guy who has all of like 18 big league innings under his belt at this point. But hey, what better time to step up? If he can step up, or Kyle Wright can step up, all that depth the Braves have, we've always talked about it playing, playing a part at some point. And hey, if that's in the World Series, what a stage for them to have to try and step up when their team is going to need them. I'm sure if Tucker gets into a game, his heart's going to be racing a million miles a minute, but hey, hopefully he can come in and make an impact and help cover some innings.
Yeah, they have to get 54 outs in game 4 and game 5 without a starting pitcher, essentially, that they trust. So that's think about it that way.
It was funny today when people were talking about options before Davidson was announced. Bryce Wilson would probably be a candidate after his heroics last year in the NLCS. And of course, they just traded Bryce. But it was funny. A few people kind of pointed that out.
The list was very long. We talked about they could have even just added another like straight reliever, like could have gone back to Jacob Webb or something. And they didn't do that. So we'll see. We talked about it last night as well, but you have Davidson, you have Wright, you have Smiley as guys who can throw multiple innings, and also AJ Minter, because he didn't pitch today. If they can get away from Minter in game 3, maybe he can throw 4 innings in game 4. I don't really know. I mean, we've seen him start, quote unquote, in a playoff game and throw like 3 2/3, whatever it was, but he's a gamer, and maybe that's an option too. So we'll see what happens, but we'll talk about that again. Hopefully Ian Anderson throws 6 innings on Friday night, and we cannot have to worry about the bullpen. Treacherous stuff could be happening. I guess we should talk about game 3 real quickly, because it is Ian Anderson against Luis Garcia of the Astros at game 3. Ian is, top number one for sure, in that if he doesn't have it on the first of 3 straight days, it can be pretty dicey in a lot of ways. So it's pretty pressure packed. Obviously it would be anyway in a World Series game, but given the way the schedule breaks down and what is not behind him, he needs to be good. And it's a tall order for him against this great lineup in Houston, but I can't say it any more plainly. Like, there's a lot of pressure on him.
Yeah, it is. I mean, no duh, biggest start of his life, and the Braves need him to be good. And we've talked about Ian. He's had some good moments and some not so good moments in the postseason. This is a very patient and balanced Astros lineup. And as we know, when Ian has his changeup working, he is as good as anyone. But if he has a night where he's not able to throw it consistently, he's going to need his secondary pitches as well. So hopefully he comes out strong. I'm sure he's going to be amped up. I know if the secondary ticket market is any indication, Truist Park is going to be a freaking zoo this weekend. And you have to be able to harness that. I think as a young guy, he of course was so good in the playoffs last year, but was pitching in empty stadiums or mostly empty stadiums. It's going to be a crazy atmosphere. And Luis Garcia was probably Houston's second best pitcher this year. He is a young guy like Anderson. He's only 24 years old. Just like Ian, it's going to be his biggest start of his career as well. And you don't need to be a baseball fan of a long time to realize the importance of winning game 3 after you split the first 2 games.
Yeah, I mean, Garcia, it's a small sample size, but a career ERA in the low 3s in about 170 innings in the majors, 24-year-old guy. But he's been good, as you said. Playoffs, not so much, but he was better in his last start, so... I don't really know what to make of him. I think our key was not that impressive to me today. But this is kind of what the Astros have, is a bunch of like mildly intriguing arms that are like kind of unproven. And that's what Garcia is. The other decision I guess they have to make for game 3, and actually you pointed this out to me and I was not thinking about this top of mind, is they have to choose who to play in the outfield. Because they can't DH. DH is now off the table. I guess it might benefit the Braves more, because Houston's got to play Jordan Alvarez in the outfield, and he's been a DH, and he's not a good fielder. but they also have to choose who to sit. I think Rosario is going to play. I feel pretty safe about that, given how hot he's been. But do you have a preference on who sits between? I guess it's probably just Jock versus Soler because they want to play Duvall in center field. I don't know.
I think Jock will probably sit. Not that Jock has been bad this postseason, but ever since that big home run off Max Scherzer, he has not been great. Maybe they will, you know, Garcia is a right-handed pitcher. So maybe they would prefer Jock's left-handed bat in there, especially in the middle or bottom half of the order to help balance it out a little bit. But they also seem to like Jorge Soler, and he's hit the ball as well as anybody since he came off the COVID list. So I'm not sure if I had to bet or guess, I would say it's going to be Jock off the bench. But as we know, he is somebody who can make an impact, whether he's in the starting lineup or coming off the bench. I think you have to probably have Duvall in center field just with his defense and familiarity and Truist. And then, yeah, I mean, you're not sitting Eddie Rosario for anything at this point. I think that's probably what will happen, but I guess we'll see how the next day and a half play out.
Yeah, Garcia, all this stuff is small sample size because he's not just pitched that many innings, but he does have a pretty decent size platoon split. He's much better against righties, which is what you'd expect. But lefties have kind of gotten him a little bit this year. They have a 348 WOBA against Garcia, a 474 slugging by left-handers against Garcia this year. So maybe that might play into it.
Maybe perhaps, they will go with Jock.
Yeah, perhaps they go. I'm just looking at this in real time because I did not know this ahead of time. So we're all learning here on the podcast. But I don't know because, like you said, I think DOBA even had it earlier. I lost that tweet. But I think Jock's numbers have been pretty hideous since that home run you referenced in the Dodgers series. And honestly, his best work in the playoffs so far has come as a pinch hitter. I don't really care about that necessarily, but since he started playing every day, it's not been very good. And Soler missed all that time, but has looked fine since he came back. Jock is the better defender, probably by a little. Like they're not, neither of them are great, but yeah, they don't seem to like Soler in the outfield all that much. So maybe that's a tiebreaker as well. I don't know what they're going to do, but keep that in mind that they have to make that choice for the first time in two games. And I think that was pretty clear what they were going to do in the last round because Soler wasn't around. But now that he is back, it's the first decision that he has to make because otherwise it's just been autopilot on the lineup card, basically. I'm looking at this again. Our favorite friends at 538 are back to 50-50, which is hilarious after two games. They're 50-50 before the series started, and they're back for the series. Fangraphs gives the Braves a 45.9% chance to win this series. So Houston's now favored there. I'm looking at the betting market right now and a couple places that have the lineup. Houston is now favored again. The Braves were favored to win the series before today, as they should have been after they won game one, but now it's swung back and it's Houston as a slight favorite. Scott, would you change anything about your prediction now that we've seen this series go through two games?
No, I don't think so. I mean, obviously the big change is the Braves won't have Charlie Morton in game five. But they did win his first start, which I think changes it dramatically. I know I didn't do the podcast last night, but if they would have lost last night and lost Charlie Morton, I think just the math doesn't work out very well at that point. I said Braves in six to start. I guess I might hedge that and move it to Braves in seven at this point if you're just talking about, I don't know, likelihood or probabilities. But I think these are two evenly matched teams. Again, game one and game two were very similar games, just opposite for each team. And I think Truist is definitely an advantage for the Braves. We've seen how well they have played at home. They're 5-0 at home this postseason. And now you have a chance to hopefully flip the series. And if you can win two out of three, great. I mean, obviously, if you can win three in a row, that would be pretty good. But at the very least, if you can win two out of three and protect home field, you're in good shape, and then you have to go and win one out of two in Houston. I think this is a series that truly, if these teams played 100 times, I think it would be pretty close to 50-50. And as we've seen, it can just take one inning, one at bat, one pitch, and it could end up being the difference in the game and in the series. And we just have to hope those go the Braves' way.
I do think that there'll be a close game at some point in the series. Yeah. Maybe not.
A little stress, a little drama.
There's no rule that there has to be a close game, but I think there probably will be at least one.
It is kind of weird because for the most part, other than game five in Los Angeles, every playoff game has been high stress with the exception of these two World Series games. I mean, there's always stress in the World Series, but Braves had a commanding lead. Top of my head, I don't think the tying run has come to the plate for either team beyond like the fourth inning in either game.
Yeah.
As you said, I'm sure that's going to change at some point. But as far as World Series games go, these have not been like you're just emotionally exhausted after 4.5 hours.
I mean, I'm physically exhausted, mentally exhausted, but I'm joking. I think you're right though. Like,
yeah.
I think Eric and I talked about it. I think it was on the podcast last night about how, you know, of course it's stressful. It's a World Series game. You're still living and dying at every pitch, but it hasn't quite been the same level as like some of those Dodgers games at the end where, cause it was actually close and you're in a tie game late or in a one run game late. And, yeah, I'm not just saying I'm looking forward to that. Maybe I am. I don't know. We'll see how that goes.
Be careful. Yeah, be careful what we wish for. Wouldn't it be nice for the Atlanta Braves to win a World Series and it be fairly low stress?
That would be okay.
After the nightly agony of that NLCS against the Dodgers, like every game took 5 years off our lives.
Yeah, I would not be upset by that.
Yeah,
I think everybody knows this, but the schedule is day off on Thursday for travel. And then Friday, Saturday, Sunday, back to back to back, all evening games, same time, same channel. Everything is still the same for all of these games in the World Series. So we'll have all the kinds of podcast content. I believe friend of the pod and co-host of ours, Sean Coleman, will have a Daily Hammer episode tomorrow morning, which will drop, I think, on Saturday morning, heading into into Friday morning, heading into that final commute and that full day of preparation. A long, long wait now between games. Two days between games is going to seem like an eternity, but we'll still be here with all the podcast content you could possibly want. Scott, if you have anything to plug, I know you wrote the recap tonight. I'm sure it was a fun one for you.
The first World Series recap of my life, and they lost. Womp womp. Maybe I'll get another chance. I do want to thank Chris for letting me do that one tonight. Yeah. Hey, man. Game one, awesome. Game two, not so awesome. We will continue to be here, and here's hoping at Truist. There's been some just magical moments in the playoffs so far with Freddie's almost basically walk-off against Josh Hader. And, of course, we talked about Chuck Peterson and Eddie Rosario and some of their heroics against the Dodgers in the NLCS. Here's hoping the next three games are wild and crazy. I know everyone who's been able to get tickets is going to bring it. And hopefully it's a fun weekend in Atlanta. I'm sure it's going to be a rocking atmosphere. Are you going to be able to get to a game, Brad, or have the tickets been tough to come by?
Let's just say I would encourage people that they have not looked at this to just Google or StubHub the tickets, and then know that I cannot afford to go to a game.
I saw people. I know Ticketmaster sucks in general, but.
They did some pre-sales, and you know the bots took over, and I know season ticket holders were able to get at least a couple generally, but yeah, I mean, short of having lots of money or a benefactor of some sort, I had no chance of being able to go, which is okay. For podcast purposes, it's probably better if I don't go, because that way I'm not sitting in traffic right now instead of recording the podcast.
True.
But yeah, as we speak, okay, Scott, don't look. What do you think the lowest current ticket price is for game three on StubHub right now for Friday?
Friday night, first World Series game in Atlanta in, what, 22 years? Oh, boy. The cheapest ticket, I'm going to say $900.
$1,100.
Oh, boy.
Game four, the current cheapest ticket for Saturday is $1,299.
Oh, so you get a discount on Friday night is what you're saying.
And then Sunday game five, which is now definitely necessary, is $1,200. So
good.
There's no way. And that's pre-fees. And you know, these things cost the fees are probably another $100+.
You pay $200 to print off your own ticket.
I'm literally looking now. I'm going to go all the way to the check. This is riveting audio. I'm going to go all the way to the checkout and see what the actual cost is.
Be careful you don't hit Apple Pay by mistake and all of a sudden you're going to game four.
Listen, that'd be fun. Okay, so as I said, the Saturday game is $12.99, the cheapest ticket. out the door on StubHub, $1,678 for one American ticket.
And I don't think you're probably not sitting in the whatever you call it, the truest. No,
that
club
is that's one ticket by itself in the middle of a row in the corner top deck.
Oh, good God.
So I'm not going unless someone, listen, if a podcast listener wants to be like, hey, donate some tickets to me and Eric, I think we'll go. But other than that, yeah. So yeah.
If a listener out there has a private jet, I would happily hop on your private jet to go to Atlanta for a game if you want to let that happen. It's only like a 5-hour flight for me. It's not that bad.
I think now that I spoiled it, podcast listeners might know that it's better for the podcast if I don't go, and maybe they won't give me tickets anymore if they were going to give me tickets. But no, yeah. I'm mostly kidding. We'll be here. Yeah. I'm planning to be here with Scott, Eric, and or both of them for all of these games. We'll figure out the schedule behind the wall, but we'll be here for podcast content. If I do happen to stumble into a ticket, I will just record an hour later, which will be fine. Thank you, Scott, for joining me. I'm delirious at this point, but I appreciate you hopping on. And as for everybody else, please subscribe to the podcast. We honestly had a massive month, and I will certainly at some point do a full-blown thank you for that. We are shattering every record on the podcast this month, and that's not a huge surprise given the World Series looming factor here, but it's been anything more. I would say it's been more than I could possibly imagine the podcast support happening. So thank you to everyone for listening and clicking around and downloading and looking at old episodes and all of the cheating ways that we've asked you to do. Please continue to do that. I'm not above it, but thank you for all the support. Sincerely, I know Scott and Eric feels the
same way. Yeah, no, thank you, everyone. We really do appreciate the support. It's been a crazy month, and as we said, these are so much fun to do, especially when you're in the World Series. Trust us, we like doing these podcasts, even on nights when they don't win. These are a whole lot better than the middle of 2016 season where they're 40 games below 500. I can promise you that.
I think there's probably been like one or two podcasts that I've ever not wanted to do. It was like the when they gave up 100 runs in the first inning that night in the
Did that one with you.
Yeah, that was not a lot miserable. Of fun. We did not have fun on that one. And then I think last year when they blew the 3-1 lead, that was not a lot. Game 7 was not a lot of fun. But other than that, I think we usually have fun on the podcast. So thank you, Scott. Again, one more time, please subscribe to the show, and you'll probably be checking out Sean Coleman's Daily Hammer on Friday morning, and then we'll be back with some combination of us after game 3. So we'll see you then.
Claude 3 from Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. With models at every point of the price performance curve, you no longer have to make trade-offs between intelligence, speed, and cost. Claude 3 Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skill and speed. And Haiku is the fastest and lowest cost model on the market, perfectly designed for high volume, high speed use cases. Join the thousands of enterprises who use Anthropic to navigate this new frontier. Visit anthropic.com/Claude, Claude, today. Jumpstart your genius with Claude 3 by Anthropic.